last month, and the timely arrangements that have been made in that regard. I also would like to apologize for the Director General, who will join us during the discussion. He is held up in another critical engagement that came up this morning, following yesterday's briefing. My name is Mziwonga Dlabane. I'm the Chief Financial Officer. On my left is Mr. John Shabani. He is the Chief of Operations in the National Department of Housing. Next to him is Ms. Yvonne Mbane. She is acting DDG Corporate Support. Mr. Mapisa is our DDG for Policy. Not present here is our DDG for Service Delivery Support, who is also engaged with the DG on the matter following yesterday's discussion. Mr. Leshabane, therefore, will be asked to do, taking into account your comments as quickly as possible without leaving the necessary details, which I usually call the minuscule approach. The introductory overview, the departmental programs that I'll take over the budget as it outlines in the presentation, and hopefully we'll then have the opportunity to engage. Thank you.
Chairperson, thank you for the opportunity. I do greet the members of the committee. Mine will be brief. I think if I refer you to the copy of the slide presentation, I'll talk through that swiftly. The overview matters, as well as the departmental program. On page 2, I will start with the executive environmental scan. That's where we assess what are the key considerations that the sector is facing, and there are largely 7. If you look at page 3, the first relates to the capacity and gearing up for delivery acceleration. This matter of capacity manifests in different ways, and we've merely sketched our understanding of that consideration around capacity. Perhaps the biggest being the capacity displacement across the country, but also globally. The mega infrastructure extension program of government, as well as the 2010 preparation and so forth, tend to attract the construction capacity away from the lower end of the market. The second issue relates to the priority projects that have been identified and the need to manage those priority projects which started out as pilots, and therefore there's a need to intensify the output from these projects, but because they also demonstrate the efficacy of the housing program. The third consideration relates to the organizational development issues, and these just following the restructuring of the department, it becomes important that we keep sight of the organizational transition and development issues. The fourth area on the next page relates to the monitoring and evaluation capabilities, and the committee has been articulate in respect of the need to be sharper at the point of delivery, and therefore that project space needed that we increase our presence in respect of supporting provinces. The fifth area is about our housing institutions. The committee is aware of the establishment of the Housing Development Agency as well as once the social housing bill is enacted, the Social Housing Regulatory Authority will also be established. But also other institutions need to be brought closer and account more accurately in respect of their performance against their mandates. The fifth area is around policy, the need to refine and strengthen policy to expedite delivery. We are not necessarily envisaging that at this point we are seeking new policies. We say policy has been established, but there may be areas of strengthening and refinement that need to be looked at to expedite delivery. And the last area is around communication. In this environment of contestation, in this environment of need, in this environment of pressure, and I'm talking pressure from a number of fronts, but there definitely the need to uphold a robust communications capability. Over the page, then there are these housing sector priorities, and there are nine. They relate to the need to introduce a housing cover for military veterans of the struggle, given the acknowledgement that this is a matter that's been long outstanding. At the same time, the second issue is around the need to intervene in the housing industry to somewhat begin to regulate the sort of spiraling of building input costs and the supply issues around that. But also the introduction of legislation and bylaws to better regulate matters around the spread of informal settlements. Otherwise, that defeats the target in terms of housing, or rather increasing access to housing. The fourth priority for the sector relates to the need to upscale our delivery of affordable rental stock. The fifth and the sixth are somewhat intertwined. The one relates to a central planning approach that would strengthen the ability to distribute and coordinate response to human settlements. The sixth is then the need to, as you adopt a central planning approach anchored around coordination, you need to be able to also attend to the funding streams, which in themselves are multiple and sometimes may not necessarily be geared the same way. The seventh priority is around the agency. I've spoken about that. But the primary issue there being the need to accelerate and strengthen the capability to acquire land and make it available for housing development. This one-off injection of resources is out of acknowledgement that the current trajectory of the housing grant is not in tandem with the target to eradicate housing needs, and therefore that one-off injection is envisaged as one intervention over and above the baseline. The ninth priority is around encouraging self-involvement, and various initiatives are looked at in that regard. If we turn over the page to page 7 and look at the departmental programs, we confirm that the departmental strategic objectives haven't changed. We just restated them. That's slide 14 there. And they're still accelerating housing delivery, utilizing housing delivery to provide jobs, ensuring that property or residential property is accessible, promoting social cohesion and mainstreaming alternative technologies and innovative planning. We have favored the committee with the departmental macro structure. In the strategic plan document itself, there is a more elaborate annexure with the, at least up to the directorate level. Chair, if I move over then to page 9, essentially the department has four programs. Program 1, necessarily by its purpose, is to provide strategic leadership, administration, and management support services. and consist of the office of the minister, office of the director general, office of the chief of operations, as well as the branch corporate services. And there are a number of sub-programs as listed on page 20. And I wouldn't necessarily get into all of them, but to just highlight a few that are more externally focused. And these relate on page 11 to international relations and the intergovernmental relations program. And again, that's a specific intervention in respect of ensuring that across the spheres of government, coordination and communication, programmatic communication is ensured, but also to ensure that in terms of the established structures, in terms of IGR framework and so forth, those structures remain active and alive and responsive to the issues that confront the different spheres. The housing institutions, again, the priorities are as indicated there. Now, over the page on page 12, there's management information services. That's where the database that informs housing choices and housing progress is managed and maintained. The other priority relates to communication services, and again, that is the sector-wide and public information function. Chair, I'll move swiftly to page 13 in respect of program 2, which relates to policy and research. The branch itself is established for the sole purpose of developing and promoting sustainable human settlement and housing policies alongside the research that is required, and it also undertakes the monitoring. So its functions are really threefold. It's the policy part, the monitoring part, as well then as research in respect of various aspects. And the sort of planned activities for the year, if you look on page 15, in respect of policy, the publication and promotion of the revised housing code becomes a priority for the year. The finalization of just the design of the insurance cover for subsidized houses is a priority. Just assistance to assistance to persons who lost both guardians, farm work housing policy. It's been revised, there's been a lot of dialogue and consultation, and therefore its finalization is imminent. Related to just our intergovernmental relations work is the policy around just a model for provinces and municipalities to combine policy, and therefore we'll provide that model. A new area, and perhaps more important area, is just this priority on just supporting provinces on policy interpretation and application. In respect of our monitoring and evaluation sub-program, the need to undertake audits in terms of occupation and constructed houses and so forth remains important and a sort of ongoing priority. But impact studies, so that we can better understand and appreciate the impact that these programs are making is important, as well as quality management and oversight. Over the page, on page 16, in respect of research, the ongoing research around human settlement and related products remains important. If I move over to then program 3, which is delivery support, on page 33, we just reaffirm the purpose of that branch, basically being simple, to provide implementation and delivery support, build capacity, liaise with stakeholders, is in fact the purpose of the branch. And the branch itself has 6 sub-programs, one relating to rental, and I'll take each one instead. Those are the sub-programs. I'll just detail what is envisaged in terms of each sub-program. On page 18 now, if we look at rentals, because we want to grow the output of affordable rentals, we needed to then start to develop a project pipeline across provinces in respect of both rental housing and community-driven housing initiatives. Because the community residential units, the old hostel redevelopment program, has been amended and enhanced, therefore there continues to be a need to go around provinces and municipalities to support their formulation of the, and packaging of the project. In the same way, the rental strategy that's recently been adopted, it needs to be popularized, but the operational demand of it needs to be explained to provinces and municipalities. And there's just work around preparing for the establishment of the Social Housing Regulatory Authority and supporting rental tribunals across provinces. Over the page, in respect of capacity development, and this is an interesting and perhaps important focal point, in that while we acknowledge that we need to secure the capacity of the sector, we also acknowledge the challenges that confront the sector in terms of capacity, because it's capacity inwardly within the public service, but because we then procure contractors to build the houses, you also find that that construction capacity in outside of government becomes important to begin to secure and lock in. And that demands that we arrange over and above the normal capacity development interventions, we respond to those challenges. In terms of program implementation support, this is specifically geared towards supporting provinces and municipalities to implement recovery plans for those projects that have been stranded or blocked, but also projects that relate to informal settlement upgrading, and provide hands-on implementation support across the field of government. Human settlement planning on page 20, that relates to the planning capability around planning for housing development over the years, multi-year, and so forth. The stakeholder liaison is really managing the interface of government, of the department, with stakeholders outside of government. And then priority projects, there are those projects that are flagship, that are piloting new ways of doing things, the N2 gateway, the Nembula, Kuzon resettlement. There are other 11 priority projects across all provinces, and they all demonstrate and implement and respond to certain aspects of the policy. And therefore, we continue to support those. And we list some of the examples of these priority projects across the provinces. And I'm not going to get into the detailed chair. I think I'll leave that for the perusal of the members at their leisure. On page 23, we just reflect on provincial delivery readiness and challenges. That graph there, just if Chair, if I may invite the committee to just look. If you look at that chart, it just reflects the performance of each province in each year, from the last, in the last 5 years, basically. Each bar would then represent delivery in that year. And there are trends that can be met around each one. But what we've done, we've undertaken a delivery readiness assessment specifically for this year, to then say what are these risks that confront provinces, and they vary. So the inability to assemble capacity, registration issues with the NHBRC, in certain cases bulk services and bulk infrastructure is not available to support denser settlements. In certain cases, there's an inability to enforce performance requirements on contractors. The seventh challenge relates to just the plans themselves that the provinces have. Some provinces, and these are acute in one, more acute in other provinces relative to the to others. But this is just an aggregation of those challenges. There are also these internal organizational challenges confronting other provinces. If you look at the number of times an MEC is shuffled in a portfolio, that has a direct impact on the performance of that province over time. And there's a correlation where the MEC has changed. Not so long afterwards, the head of department will also change. And that has impacted quite significantly on certain provinces. Chair, Program 4, which is housing development funding, on page 25, really this is where the funding of national housing and human settlement programs in terms of the Act is undertaken, but also this is where the financial management within the department is also located. And it also attends to matters related to housing finance and the access around that. Chair, this branch is the CFO's office and consists three functions: financial services, that's on page 26. And again, that's inwardly looking in terms of managing the finances of the department. There is another sub-program, grant or fund management, that specifically relates to management of the grant. And the last part relates to then the equity issues in terms of housing finance. And the Office of Disclosure is located here. The interface with the financial services charter process is located here. Chair, and matters around oversighting the lending practices is also managed there. Chair, I will stop there and hand over to the CFO to just take you through the departmental budget breakdown. That's in order, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. The budget overview, as outlined in the estimate of national expenditure, reflects the four programs as outlined, which are a grouping of some of the activities that are falling under the branches, as he, Mr. Shobani indicated previously. The programs are administration, policy, research, housing development support, housing development finance, and that's on page 28. In terms of the numbers, the program for housing development finance continues to be the predominant cost-driving program across the board. Currently growing from 10.171 billion to 14.67 billion over the MTF period. Growth over the previously published numbers and the equivalent, what would have been the equivalent taking the growth estimate for 2010-11 is 1.1 billion in the, sorry, 1.1 million in the first year, 202.8 million in the second year of the coming MTF, and then the in the third MTF, almost 2 billion growth, largely because of the growth in program 4. If you look at the economic classification compensation, again, provincial transfers play the biggest role, followed by goods and services, and then transfers to the departmental agencies for various activities that are undertaken under that. The third area that reflects the strategic movement and the growth that has been indicated, largely reflecting a phased implementation of the new organogram over the MTF, grows from the compensation of employees grows from 154 million to 212.6 million in the MTF. That's just broadly the analysis of expenditure is that, as you will have seen, the budget is dominated by transfer payments, which constitute about 95% averaging over the MTF. And as you shall see, the budget grows from nearly 9 billion in 2007-08, which is the year just passed, to 15.3 billion in 2010 9 billion in 2007-8, and then to 15.3 billion in 2010-11, averaging over the period. Obviously, there would be years that are above the average at 19.4% growth. Included in the conditional grant, which is the transfers to provinces, as I indicated before, would be the projects. Some of the key material ones would be the projects relating to N2, the Zanimbula project, the Kutong. But all of the other projects were already mainstreamed within the program, within the allocations to provinces. 808 is allocated for the implementation of our social housing program, largely the Randall program, so that we can increase Randall stock available to the sector. Program one, I think, is a standard program that deals with strategic leadership and administrative management of services for the department, which holds the executive authority, accounting officer, the chief of operations, and then the corporate services. As I indicated, it goes from 1.126.5 to 181 million over the MTF. Its major cost driver is goods and services and compensation to employees. On page 32, as I indicated, it goes from 126.5 to 181, a growth of averaging 14% per annum over the 2 year period. Then program two, which is housing policy, research and planning. The purpose is outlined in the national estimates of expenditure to develop the most national sustainable settlement housing policy supported by a responsive research agenda. And then plus the monitoring and assessment of implementation performance and impact of national housing policies and programs to provide integrated information. The sub-programs falling under that, management, policy development, research, monitoring and evaluation information, and then contribution to our international responsibility, particularly in an habitat country contributions, as I said, for year to year, and then housing settlement planning program. The main cost drivers is compensation and goods and services, which take up the bulk of the expenditure, almost 19%. That's at the bottom of page 33. And then on page 34, we can look at program 3, which is the housing delivery support program, which on page 5 consists of service delivery support, the general sub-program to host the management services of that program. Service delivery support and housing, people's housing program, stakeholder management, intergovernmental and international relations, capacity development, prior projects, phasing out of subsidy programs and communication programs. The phasing out of old subsidy programs is not getting any funding for this year, and largely it reflected the interest subsidy that was provided for historically. The cost driver again is compensation and goods and services. Critical that we note that this is a program that is going to be the one that reflects what the COO indicated as managing the in-phase support on the deliver support at the process of delivery. And therefore, it's expected that it would carry quite a lot of costs relating to matters to support that. It grows by 19.1% average over the period. And areas are capacity development that take up most of the large part of the allocation growth. And then program 4 is the program that contains the Integrated Housing and Human Settlement Grant, and really deals with the funding of the programs and the management of the matters related to DORA and home loans and mortgages. The main cost driver, as indicated previously, is the provincial revenue process in terms of the integrated housing and human settlement grant, growing at from 9.8 billion to almost 10 billion in the first year of the year, 14.22 billion by the end of the year. The other cost driver is the transfer to departmental agencies, the housing institutions, and the compensation of employees and goods. The following page 38, we just reflect what has been published numbers in terms of the division of revenue legislation and the annex charge to that. To DORA. 2008 allocations and then 2009-10, 10-11 indicative allocations which may be adjusted on increase going forward. They reflect how the money has been distributed amongst the provinces, which is largely based on a formula that takes into account the whole lot of issues around development, poverty, indicators, population, migration trends, etc. Then what we've done is we've summarized from the business plans of the various provinces based on the statements too that are equivalent of the estimates of national expenditure, how the provinces collectively would be spending the money in the various sub-programs, those that are directly linked to delivering units, and those that are spent items necessary for the process. And this structure is based on the structure agreed with National Treasury, and it reflects the various instruments which are dealt with in the program. And they are largely financial intervention activities, incremental housing program activities, and then social and rental housing programs activities, plus the other related to, and then the rural housing program activities that are reflected. And obviously, the various details in regard to each of the provinces are then in the statements that are published by the provinces, and the members will be able to look at that one. I think Chair would try as much as possible to go through the presentation within the time, so that there is sufficient time to engage on that. I thank you.
Thank you very much. I just want to make apology for the chairperson of this committee. He is off sick at the moment. He's in bed with flu. So that's why he's got an acting chair. I'm sorry that I didn't say that from the start. Honorable, excuse me. Honorable members, the floor is yours. Honorable Fowler, yeah?
When must we come back?
I can say, person, just a couple of questions, not much. I want to come back to the start off with the housing, the priorities. Now, the priority number two on page five, the intervention into the housing industry. Residential property market to curb the spiraling cost of construction. Now, I'm just wondering how is the department going to do this, because this is driven from out of the private sector. And for government to start intervening into the private sector is going to be problematic. How are they going to do that? Of course, the cost is a supply and demand thing. and it's regulated by the market. So I'm just curious to know how do they going to do this, because you can't expropriate and you can't do things like that. Exactly how they intend to intervene into the private sector in the cost of housing, because cement is going up. Are they going to subsidize cement? What does that intervention do? And do they think it's going to be successful? Because as I said, it is driven by supply and demand, and it's outside the government. It's the market that is driving this thing. And also, this is I link it to the number 9 priority also, to introduce me to assist people with building material. If they start doing this, are they not promoting inflation? Because it's got a cost effect. And I just want to know how are they going to do. But the big question that I've got, is the fact that the 95% of their budget is dominated through transfers to the provinces, and I think we talk about 9 billion. Now the question that arises here is, consistently provinces are underspending, and has the department got the capacity to monitor and evaluate this? If you look at the past history, I would say no. Because then, because I know in the Free State there was huge underspending on housing. Although one of the priority areas is the capacity, they got something to do with capacity. But I'm just wondering, have they got the capacity to oversee this? Because that is fundamentally where deliveries taking place. Now, if a province like the Free State underspends 160 million in a financial year, I'm afraid to say that somewhere something is wrong, because these are DORA grants, it's conditional grants. They were supposed to submit a business plan to the department, and on the basis of that the business plan, the grant was given to him. And so my question is there monitoring systems in place? Are they good enough for them? Are they effective enough? Of course, as I said, there's underspending, and the opposite of the underspending is fiscal dumping. You get that some of these provinces in the last 2 months, they spent all of the money, so there's a big spike of it. How is the department going to monitor this, and how are they going to counter this? And then just the last question is, I'm just wondering, with the backlog of housing and the budget is growing at a steady pace of 19%, are we playing catch up here? Are we going to catch up here, or are we just trying to keep it the same, the status quo? Because we must catch up somehow. And I'm just wondering if the 19% growth in their budget, it doesn't look to me that we ever be in front. We will always be behind. So I'm just want to know if they feel comfortable with this budget, that they will catch up with the backlog. Thank you, Shepard.
Thank you, Honourable Comrade.
Yeah. My questions are going to be a bit more general. I know we asked to be quick, so I didn't expect detail. But what I'd like to hear about is the situation of the actual housing development in the provinces, and how far is the department or the provinces as such with allocating the I forget what the term is, for the municipalities to become the housing agency the accreditation, that's what I was looking for, of the municipalities. If I'm correct, in Mpumalanga, we haven't accredited any municipality yet, in the Malatli, and the Witbank municipality, which is the biggest, is now applying for accreditation. That's my last information. That seems to be a very slow process, and in the meantime, the things are falling apart, and you get developments like the ones we've uncovered in Bethel, where the contractors, and I'm sure it's partly corruption, but also bad supervision, used inferior mixtures of cement and sand, and the houses are now falling on top of their people. We had examples of housing developments in the Eastern Cape, which were below the high water mark. We've seen so many examples. Last year, I drove from Kokstad to Pietermaritzburg, and I drove past hundreds of half-built RDP houses. And I'm just wondering, where are we with that thing now? The other one is, I saw here that there's the backyard rental program. Could you explain that one to me, please?
Time to build up capacity. What is the state of affairs? So that there's project tracking. You're talking of project tracking. What do you mean by project tracking? If you talk of project tracking, it means things are not yet, up to scratch. The housing subsidy vis-a-vis the rising cost. What is the position? I think the cost has risen so tremendously that I believe the subsidy may not qualify to put up an accepted structure. So it must be affected by the rising. You're talking of revised national housing code. If that could be explained. And you're also talking for unblocking the stalled project. Why are they stalled? Stalled by who? So that they need some kind of unblocking. Thank you, Chair.
Any other moment? Okay. I just want to listen to the question of the Honorable Watson about the backyard rental program. If you could just elaborate on that. Because I see you've got targeted output unit 1,000 and the funds allocated is 48,000. So I just wanted to find out how did you get that figure. But it's over to you.
Sorry, can you
open? On page 40, the slide before. That's right. The targeted output vis-a-vis the funds allocation. How did you get to that figure?
Chair, thank you very much. I think I will deal with some of the questions and then others, my colleagues, will supplement that and attend to that. Chair, let me deal with the first question. The interventions in the industry. While it is accepted that it's a function of supply and demand in respect of procuring materials, it has been evident that unless the public sector and the private sector collaborate, you'll have these spikes in demand and spikes in supply. So it's to smooth out the shocks in the system. And that can be achieved through several means. It can be what we loosely would call joint planning. We know we are going to spend $10 billion. We begin to quantify how much bricks generally is that. So you can then talk to the brick manufacturers so that their production is geared in that regard. Similarly, cement and steel and so forth. Now, clearly, the intention is to smooth out those peaks that often happen. So it can be achieved through regulation, and regulation is probably seen as the last resort. But at the same time, the Treasury is sensitive about administered prices and so forth, so we can't intervene necessarily in that context. But the interventions that are possible through joint planning and dialogue with the sector, between sectors, is possible to smooth out those spikes. But it ensures collaboration as well. There's work that is currently being planned with, for example, Lafarge. The intention is to set up, for Lafarge to set up specific cement plants and concrete mixing capabilities around these major projects that we have. In that way, it allows for smooth of supply flow so that you don't wake up one day and be told there's no cement available. So that's the envisaged intervention. But again, it's a subject of research to say what is possible, how far can these matters be done, what the impacts would be of each one of the options. In terms of self-help, it's part of our community-driven housing initiatives. Effectively, there are certain areas in the country where, because either of distance or remoteness, it is not possible to plan a contractor-led housing project. But you cannot then say those people then do not access the service or the house, the subsidy. So the idea here is to look at context-specific responses so that for those people that are in the remote areas, they can then access the subsidy and be able to access building materials so they can then build for themselves. In that way, they still access the benefits because they are qualified to benefit. But it's more the means of getting them to get the house. It's not so much subsidizing materials or anything. It's instead of a subsidy that is linked into a project, the beneficiary would receive, and this is work that is underway. We are exploring various options. Is it a voucher? How is this going to work? And we just prioritize that. The transfers to the provinces, yes, that's correct. The 9 billion odd rand is the grant itself. As per formula, it's divided across the provinces. The issue of underspending and the capacity of the national department, that's been a matter that's been with us for a while. In my presentation, I alluded to the fact that the department has had to restructure itself. If you look at page 8, we provided the macro structure of the department. That branch, second in of the four branches at the bottom, the delivery support branch, on the one side, it is introduced to be able to support provinces in expediting the plans that they have. In this financial year, it started late in the last quarter of the last financial year, where we sat down with each and every province, going through their business plan, and saying, this is not feasible, this is not realistic, please adjust that, modify that, align that so that you can then optimize your performance. Now, over and above the analysis, is then we can isolate provinces where we really see that there are difficulties and major risks we've outlined the risks themselves, but at the same time, we had to then say there are certain provinces where the risks are too many, and therefore we prioritize our support to that province. We have prioritized the Eastern Cape, we've prioritized the Mpumalanga, we've prioritized the Free State. Now, effectively, it's to provide targeted support so that the risks can better be managed. Remember, the risk can't be taken away, but it must be mitigated. But the new arrangement with the NHBRC is that it is not only a bystander watching. It has to actively work in tandem with the provinces and jointly plan with the provinces so that where projects are approved, the NHBRC is part of the process to enroll, to do the necessary quality controls, and so forth. But related to this new branch,
in line with that, what content are the three projects?
Thank you, Chair. If you look at page 23, it's more page 24, where we're just reflecting on the readiness assessment that was undertaken to isolate the risks. These nine risks on page 24, you would find that in the provinces which we have isolated, the risks are more manifest than in other provinces. So you would find that the province, if you look at the three provinces that I've mentioned, they are in the middle of a restructuring. That's on the one side. So that in itself is a major institutional paralyzing effect if not attended to specifically and in a particular way. And that's where we are prioritizing to say we will provide you with support so that performance is not stranded. The questions around bulk services, and if you look at specifically the weaknesses in the plan, because that's where the problem starts. If the plans in themselves are not optimal and are not sound, clearly the output is going to be problematic. So we have to target the plans that are there and ensure that the plans are credible, the plans are viable, the plans in themselves are achievable. And in so doing, and you, again, the response to the provinces is not a blanket. In the Eastern Cape, we've had to go the Section 100 route. In other provinces, it suffices to arrange, as per the Housing Act, these measures of support. And it does not mean that other provinces are not, we don't do anything. There is engagement with those provinces, and they are monitored on a monthly basis in terms of their performance. Now, there is a chief directorate that's been established to increase our capacity to monitor and evaluate. So that attends, that's a balance, because you have to be available to support at the delivery side, but at the same time, you have to be able to stand back and monitor the overall system. And that's why the Chief Directorate monitoring is available. Chair, I can confirm that the housing backlog in the country is enormous. The funding, the minister has always maintained, the funding is not adequate relative to the task at hand, but the funding is available to do what is possible. While the grant is growing significantly, a few years ago the housing grant was what, 4 billion. This year we're talking 10 billion, give and take. The grant is growing, But what is really of issue is that one of the priorities is to secure this one-shot injection to attend to certain specific methods. Now, we have sufficient funding to do what needs to be done. That's on the one side. But if you are to eradicate the backlog, there are certain quantums of funding that are required. For example, the minister is on record is saying we would want, in order to meet or eliminate the backlog, we need to deliver over 500,000 units per year. At the moment, we're delivering in the region of 250,000 units a year. So obviously, to move up to 500,000 units a year, it would demand a concomitant increase in the grant itself. But as the committee would be aware, the allocations across the sectors are a function of balancing the different competing needs of development across the country. So in part, the motivations are there, but at the same time, they have to be balanced against other priorities of public service. Chair, let me deal with accreditation. Yes, accreditation is deemed to be slow, and its slowness is not necessarily a function of malice or anything. The reality is that the municipalities that have been prioritized to be accredited in themselves are not in a position to can be accredited. Otherwise, the risk is that the housing function will be stranded if it's migrated into a municipality that does not have the capability to manage it. So that process of capacity enhancement, we were quite ambitious because we thought it's possible to do these things quicker. But the municipalities, unfortunately or fortunately, they tend to want to be certain, absolutely certain. And there's a process of organizational restructuring in a municipality. They have to set up certain functions that they didn't have before. A housing portfolio in a municipality. The governance arrangements that have to account for the function that you are migrating. So the risk is always there. If you move the function and the receiving sphere of government or institution is not ready, that function will not be performed. It will be stranded. And the last thing that we want to see at this point is a stranded housing delivery function. And that's acknowledging, and that's really the intention of accreditation, is to improve or increase the number of players who are directly responsible for the housing function in addition to the 9 provinces. But that has to, and the capacity audits that have been undertaken also confirm that, in fact, you couldn't really simply just move the function. It had to be informed by necessary capacity adjustment. The last matter that I will respond to, Chair, the second last, capacity, is there capacity? There is capacity. The fact is, there are matters, or rather there are forces and dynamics beyond the public service that impact on the capacity that's required to deliver housing. Partly that relates to construction capacity, partly it relates to the capacity of the supplier to produce sufficient material. It also relates to the capacity to manage the process of housing development. So it is varied. And when we acknowledge that there are capacity pressures, the fact is construction in other parts of the world is such that they are no longer building developmentally. They are building for excellence. If you look at Dubai, they build things that none of us have thought are possible before. And they pay salaries that are quite intense. And therefore, we have to position ourselves globally and say, what are these forces that impact on our capability to deliver the service, and we have to respond to those. And we can't compete with the people in Dubai, really. They pay between three and ten times what gets paid. Now, that competition is too intense, but the least we can do is to be conscious of that and plan accordingly and lock in the capacity that can be locked in. So, Chair, yes, there is capacity. When we want to undertake project tracking, it's to improve accountability. We would want to be able to say to any province, you said you are going to build this project. Our own independent tracking, not relying on the provinces, is to be able to periodically have a sense of where these projects are at, and therefore take the necessary measures to counter any problem that could arise. So it is really as part of improving our capability for monitoring, but also strengthening the accountability that is required. Chair, I'm sure the CFO will talk to the Mr. Mapisa will deal with the backyard rental and the code. Chair, let me address the block project. The block projects, or rather projects, get blocked for a number of reasons, some of which could be inflation related. Any housing development is not concluded in a year. It gets initiated in year one. Certain things get to happen, land is prepared, services are installed, year two, year three, year four. So there's a process of development. Now, in that period, certain things can happen. Inflation, if it's not factored in originally, it would cause that project not to be viable in year two, maybe year three. In other cases, what you then find, there are community dynamics. Council are here, they don't agree, the community this, there's a contestation, you can't move. In certain cases, there are matters of legal contestation. This contractor either dies or the owner, and therefore the law of contracting, you say that contract can either be ceded or taken over by somebody, or depending on how the company was structured, you find that it's locked into the estate. So there are many factors, and I'm not even doing justice. I'm just highlighting a few. Now, we have had to study all of those slow-moving projects and understand these nuances and put a strategy and policy in place to say, this is how we are going to deal with this. They will need to be unblocked so that they can then be completed. And that's really the initiative here, Chair, that we're seeking to respond to and eliminate the blight of projects that were started and have built either to the foundation or up to the roof in their various stages. But it also allows us to strengthen the contracting arrangements that are in place. Chair, I will pause there. The code will be dealt with, rental housing will be dealt with. I'm sure the CFO can deal with the cost of the housing vis-a-vis the subsidy amount itself and the inflation challenges.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Chair. I think there was a reference to the figure largely. This program is largely in Gauteng, and that's where it is. The number is 48,000 per unit, and it would have taken into account the inflation increases, the anticipated increase to the quantum itself that would be allocated. In some cases, there are escalation. Policy approved escalation provisions that relate to conditions that are peculiar. For example, we have disabled situations that you have to provide additional allocation in order to provide water access, etc. We have soil conditions, escalation approved. approvals that will ensure that in particular cases, for example, in the Western Cape and Eastern Cape, it has the compensation allowances, etc. And all of these are provided for. But I think the escalated quantum on the average per unit in terms of the subsidy is around 45,000 at the moment. And this was provided for at the time through using the BR index projections as well of how the inflation situation would be pertaining. Obviously, over time, this would have to be adjusted as the inflation situation seems to be changing. But I think for planning purposes, people have made use of those kinds of assumptions for projecting. the revised housing code is correctly a revised housing code. We have been operating with a code that was developed around to 1998 to 1999, which is a requirement of the Housing Act that there shall be a code. The minister must determine a code which prescribes the manner in which housing development takes place, etc., which includes all the programs we have in the code. The committee shall remember that in 2004, the department developed the comprehensive plan for sustainable human settlement, then which is done to breaking new ground, which effectively meant that quite a lot of the issues that were, because it was a product of an analysis of the delivery for the first 10 years of our democracy, and therefore there were certain things, the approach, for example, to dealing with sustainable human settlement. Integrated human settlements approach, etc., therefore required that we need to change even the manner in which we're doing things and the rules applicable for that. So we had to do a complete analysis of that particular code and replace it with a new code that is responsive to the demands of the new plan, the comprehensive plan for sustainable human settlements. Now, the various segments of that policy have been developed over time. They are now consolidated into what would be a code that would then reflect all of the issues and the ethos that is in the new plan. The question about the needs, I think you did respond to this, of the catch-up and the escalation of the prices. But the truth is that the inflationary they do take into account relevant inflationary indexes that relate to housing, and we escalated the quantum based on those. And I think the 40 square meter minimum norm that we have at the moment is based on work that was done around quantification at a particular stage, quantification of what would be required if you want to develop a certain type of a product, which is not the case. And obviously, over time, we have to ensure that we keep it in line with inflation so that it doesn't create further blockages in the system. But I think we're watching those as we are monitoring the performance of the market related to this, to ensure that we keep up to the prices in that area. I'll leave Mr. Makisa to answer.
I will just augment and just try to respond to some of the inferior material. We have the NHBRC who have the responsibility to check the quality of the material. What they usually do, they go to the project site and they test the bricks. There are projects that they have stopped because the bricks were of inferior quality. They work together with the South African Bureau of Standards. So they collect bricks from each and every project. They take a sample of those bricks, and they are subjected to a test. So that program, we are finding a solution in a way. Time will tell whether the new BNG house would be able to sustain itself. And then the question of the code, I wanted just maybe to talk about the RDP house, as we know it, the square house, that is a typical what is the product of the old code. The new code now has bring us a new product. We now have a 40 square meter house. The specifications have changed. It's a more viable and a quality house. The product is different. And the plan in terms of integration, the code is instructing people to be able to plan in a more scientific way to integrate so that we do not perpetuate building locations in the middle of nowhere, which we did during RDP. We are now building a breaking new ground. We are now coming to the breaking new ground. We are building integrated, sustainable communities. And I always would indicate to the colleagues about the variation. The new code does take into the consideration the variation in construction. If you are building in a steep area, the new housing code will tell you what to do, and you make a variation allowance of about, I think, not more than 20%, depending on if you are building on clay soil, if you are building on sandy soil. There are considerations, very, very scientifically expressed and very instructive in the housing code, advising people on what to do, which were not there previously, in order to fast track a delivery. That is the new code. And I may talk about the accreditation is covered, cost of delivery is covered. And maybe I should try to attempt to answer the difficult question of the backyard rental. Yes. It started, I was in my other job, I was in Gauteng province, and so I know exactly how it started. We were having the program of eradication of informal settlements. Now, some of the informal settlements are within people's yards. And those plots that are more than 100 years old in the location, some of them are bigger, and they have up to maybe 20 shacks in the yard. The system is already carrying. It's a very awkward situation. Now it was an attempt to intervene and say, if we introduce the unit, then you do away with all the slum in your yard. And then it was an attempt to build an extra unit. It was an experiment or a pilot. And at the time, only 700 units were identified as and those areas that are more than 100 years. Specifically, Van der Bijl Park, Wipatong, if you remember, and Orlando East, the old Orlando East, the town. Yeah, their houses initially are one bedroom houses, so it was possible to add one unit. And this experiment, actually, the houses were built. Just a monitoring report can indicate what the success and what the success. And that's how it was controversial in that as a national government, we only allowed it maybe because it was an experiment. I don't know how it was handled then. However, this is where it all started. It was an attempt to do away with the shacks inside of people's yards. And they tried to clear those as well because they defy certain countries. In certain places, more in terms of places. Yeah. That's how this thing came into our books.
And I have to follow up on that. What I don't understand is if it's in the backyard of somebody's property and the state pays 48,000 rand, who does it belong to? Sorry. Yeah, let me repeat. If it's a backyard shack is built on somebody's property, but it's financed by government to the tune of 48,000 or whatever, who does it belong to? And who rents it?
Well, I don't have the project, but I can attempt to answer from the head. It is enhancement of an existing property, and which we can call consolidation subsidy. I don't know now if that is 40, but I think, but at the time it was between 7,000 and 10,000. That was being introduced by the state. Yes, it was, and it was the formula was used as a consolidation subsidy, a because those houses were even were built. That if we were to use discount benefit scheme of the old system, those houses will not be houses. They are inferior to the RDP. Yes. So it is enhancement of the product that is already existing. So it is the product eventually is in, the title deed is that one of the owner, and then the additional room, this is the one bedroom house, you add a shack, and then you add a room with about 7,000. That was how it was calculated.
Why do you call it backyard rental, and now we've got 1,000 more budgeted for?
Yeah. Maybe the details will be in the project document. We may like to
look at.
What follow up on that, in the Western Cape, specifically in my constituency, or the constituency that I've been deployed to, there's more backyard dwellers than there are registered homeowners or registered in terms of your rental stock with your flat and all that. In some of the flats, there's about four in the yard. It's about between four and eight shacks or in the house on a flat. Now, we've got difficulty in the bulk infrastructure. Now, in terms of that in Gauteng, what happened in Gauteng, what was the bulk or was the bulk infrastructure? Has it been provided? Because people charge the people rent and they charge them for water and electricity.
I will try maybe just to wind up what I was saying. This is the revitalization project of the what we call the 20 townships. And it is a package that was put together by the province. So that now the municipality came with the road. That is why the areas involved now. There is no problem of roads because it came as a package. The city said we are going to build roads. The city said we are going to upgrade the sewers, we are going to upgrade the water pipes, we are going to upgrade this, and to some extent that was done. That is why the mayor went public to say in Johannesburg at the moment there is no, even in the poorest area, there is no area where there is no route. All roads are tarred, even in the locations, even the poorest area, all roads are tarred. Because it came as a package from housing, this is what they were trying to do. But they did address this. It was a provincial strategy. But maybe I should.
Sir, it may be useful that we distinguish between backyard dwellers and backyard renters.
Yeah.
The nuance in respect of backyard dwelling. It plays itself, as the members would be aware, in that why, and that certain questions arise as to why are those people who've been in backyards for a long time as well, are not prioritized in allocation. So you find that there's a nuance around allocation. But, Chair, it goes without saying, any township, and I'm talking township technically, not township as in the black areas. When a township is planned, it's planned for a certain carrying capacity. So the infrastructure that is provided there is provided for that carrying capability. Now, when you have extensions to dwellings and backyards or back dwellings, second dwellings and so forth, it increases the density of that settlement. And when the density goes up, the intensity of the infrastructure that's available is often, that infrastructure gets overloaded. So what tends to happen, therefore, is that, and there are many places, the area the chair referred to, if you go to Soweto in Dlamini, and these places where there are so many backyard units, most of them are informal anyway, but they use one toilet. The electricity supply is for that one original house. The water supply. So So what then happens in that is that that service, those services, they get overloaded. And when they get overloaded, there's always a risk that they will collapse at some point. Some municipalities have taken the initiative to increase the carrying capacity of those services to deal with the problem almost entirely because the people are there. However, a more permanent solution, Chair, remains that the people who are, because they are informally dwelling, that is why you would find those people having applied and they are on the demand database. When the housing program rolls on, they will then benefit as part of that demand database. So, and that is why the program, the housing program, provides so many instruments so that you can then deal with the differences in terms of preference. Other people who don't want a freestanding house, they prefer sort of cluster or medium density walk-up units because that's where they've always been. So, I'm just saying, Chair, it's important. It may be useful that we distinguish that we perhaps look specifically into how and at what speed the people in who are in backyard dwellers are accessing opportunities. And there's a dynamic there, Chair, because the landlord, for them, it's an income-generating capability. And therefore, when you strengthen the municipal bylaws that control the prevalence of these structures in backyards, you will therefore find that you wouldn't have this perpetuation because most of the people in the back, I think the indications are that the people of all our housing projects, between 50 and 60% are people who are from informal settlements. The balance is the people you find in who are renting backyard dwellings. And the nuances in that, Chair, are so deep. Even where I grew up in Soweto, in Klipspruit, we had four. And I'm saying four, I mean huge. Built without, and it's formal, it's a formal structure, but it's built without the municipal approval. We are no longer there, it's still standing there. Yes. So I'm just saying there's a much deeper nuance in these matters than they meet the eye, and therefore it would, Chair, and we may just look into our studies that we've conducted around rental, informal rental, backyard rental, and so forth, and perhaps share that with the committee, because we have, through the Social Housing Foundation, we have looked at these methods, and it may be useful that we perhaps make that available to the committee.
Thank you, Chair. That would be very, very fantastic. We would be very happy to have that information. Honourable Van Rooyen and then the Honourable Mia. Welcome, Honourable Mia. And then the Honourable Matlanyane. Can we close the rest of that? Honourable Wolfart.
Chairperson, thank you. Yeah, the question that I was going to ask you, that I didn't ask you first round, was the farm workers housing policy. This needs to be going on for some time. How far are we with that thing? Because it impacts on the rural areas and also farm workers that are getting evicted from farms and things like that. So my question around that one is when will that be finished? But I just want to come back to my original question on this. If you look at that page, when you see the readiness, the graph there, it's not a very nice picture that is given there to us. Because there's only one province that increased from the previous year to this year, the output, and that was Mpumalanga. But they're one of the ones that is in the ICU at the moment. All the other provinces actually
declined their output. Now, but I want to link it again to this thing of the capacity of the department, which I explained they have got this director. But what is the vacancy rate in the department? Because I think we must now talk, you know, how many people are there? What is the vacancy rate? Is it going up? Is it going down? And again, I'm concerned. If you really look at this, it's not a very good picture. And then the monitoring of this, then monitoring becomes critical from the department to turn this around. And you got 9 billion rand that you have to disperse and manage. I'm just worried about that. So the staffing and the vacancy rate will be quite important this matter. Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you, Chair. Let me use the privilege of being lost and found myself in this meeting. Just two issues, Chair. One on NHBRC. I've been struggling to get a comprehensive response from the provincial Department of Housing on the question of the capacity of the NHBRC. They are saying correctly that there is a delay in the registration of projects as well as emerging contractors. That, if you understand how the NHBRC would work, if there are delays there, then there will be delays in the project, and there would be challenges with regard to quality, because they don't have the capacity to inspect periodically. The projects are moving faster than NHBRC. Hence, you find a number of projects in the Eastern Cape find the houses collapsing, you know. So that's the first point. The second one is, having gone round through parts of the Eastern Cape, I have a major problem, and that is in regard to the engineering standards that have been allowed with regard to RDP houses. My understanding, an engineering standard is an engineering standard. It can't be adjusted for RDP houses. But when you build your own private house, you are given a set of engineering standards. Engineering standards should cut across. Let me make one small example. Because contractors build differently from others, and I have a problem with that. The contractor would put in the corner where the wall meets the other wall a pillar with no gadgets linking to the brick. Obviously, the bricks would come right down without linking to the pillar, and that structure will never be stable. And indeed, some of them are beginning to move away from the pillar, which is linked to the foundation and therefore anchored there. The question remains, why are we allowing engineering standards which are different for our people, different from the engineering standards that we know? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
The walls inside the house. You know, the house was so poorly built that if you try to stand against the wall, you could feel that, no, this is just about to fall. And we questioned why our people are being put in those type of houses. We even challenged the municipality. Just for a month, just allow yourself to go and stay in that house after it has been completed. But the most problematic situation was, you have inspectors from the Department of Housing. You have inspectors from the municipality. You have inspectors from NACDRC. But all these groups are failing to really come up with the standards that are required. And you question the NACDRC. They say to you, no, this is, I don't remember, they had a term. There is a booklet that guides how they should build the houses. And unfortunately, on the pages that they made for us, they made copies for us, on the pages, it was saying exactly that there must be no interlink between the two walls that are joining each other. The steel that they used, you could see that come 2 years, that thing is going to just go down completely. So that's another problem that is existing in Limpopo. But on quality houses, we can say when we talk to them, there are people that are monitoring whether there are quality houses. I mean, bricks will be bricks. But when you come to the mixture, that's where the problem lies. You know, you take the mixture, you put it under your feet, you crush it, it goes like sand. And that's the reality. Honorable Botha once brought the mixture where we went in Limpopo, a project that is at Hamabondo. And right now, I know members are worried. They are going to have to go and campaign. And we have to go and go to those areas. But what are we going to say to the people? We failed you. We can't even correct the mess that you are in right now. And the most problematic situation is that you find old women, you know, these grannies that are looking after the grandchildren. And the grandchildren usually just open the door and get into this house with that poor mixture that was used. You take a lousy, you know, stick, you move it around the I don't know what you call it.
The mortar.
Yes. You know, there's stuff that goes out and, you know, the whole mixture falls off. But that's exactly where we're putting our people. That's exactly what we're saying when we're saying we're delivering houses. And this needs to be looked seriously into. The provincial department in Limpopo is very much aware of what I'm talking about. You mentioned something of the growing grant. But to me, if a contractor disappears for 4 years, even if the grant is growing, that's not going to make a difference. Because everything has now been completely, you know, the cost is rising dramatically. So whether we got 4 million 4 years back, today if we have 15 million, it doesn't even make a difference. That's something that we need to look into. The other thing that I want to ask is on the issue of the land problem. For houses, we know for a fact that we're sitting with a problem. I don't find it. I'm not sure whether I missed it when the presentation was done, where we are having a program of addressing the land problem in as far as housing is concerned, and I think the most important thing is to say that, you know, Chairperson, I wish for acting Chairperson, I wish for a time where if Honorable Watson and Honorable Fabwen could agree, we talk with the officials they become politicians, and they maybe with what we experience when you go down to the people, when they do the same, they'll understand the predicament that we are in. Because I'm telling you, Honorable Watson is going to find it difficult to go to the people and say to them, this is what we're doing, as a government we're delivering. And we so much would love to go there. But I'm not sure if our voices are being heard. Some of us are just saying, no, if I don't make it back, at least I won't have, I'm no more growing my hair because it's becoming more gray every day when I go to Limpopo. You are called every day. I know Honorable Azam, he comes home around 12, 1 o'clock. He has to just drive around the Western Cape, and, you know, he's trying to solve something that is not in his hands. Thank you, Jefferson.
Well, thank you, Honorable Makanela. Honorable Bolisha.
Thank you. I think I'll repeat some of the questions, specifically the one that we visited last year in September in the Eastern Cape. They called the Kabombe housing it is in Kauke, where the minister promised the people of the Eastern Cape that he's going to make sure that that project is finished by December last year. What has happened, the problem of that particular project was the quality of the material that was used. And also in one of the areas, the same area, it was also a concern that those projects were approved in 1995. But what has happened, they built on this slab. And the Department of Housing in the Eastern Cape, they said they've got budget for that. And I just want to make a follow-up whether that has happened or not. Because if it has not yet happened, then it will create a serious problem around particularly the National Department, because the minister has made that commitment. And the other issue, Chairperson, is the issue of accreditation of municipalities. I know that some recommendations are made by the provinces, but I'm not sure whether the department really, when they are giving that accreditation, do take into consideration to see any project that was officiated by those municipalities that are accredited. I'm raising this because there is another municipality in Tonjane that was given an accreditation. I think it was in 1998, but the houses that were built there, but the problem was also the attitude of the mayor for that area in particular. But we raised that issue with the Department of Housing in the province, but at the same time we raised I raised it in the debate, and the minister said he was going to look at it. It's from Tonjane. And also, when we talk about the housing code, that it has been revised. I'm not sure whether it was revised this year or early last year, because we also raised a concern when we visited the Benin last year. In Kayamandi area, where there was a project of also, but it falls under EPWP, but it's the housing project. Those houses are built by Tubilisha Homes. We had a concern of the basins that are put in those houses, because they were using the plastic ones rather than the ones that we said. We believe that they are of quality. and they said they are doing that in terms of the housing code. So if the department can also look at the code and then compare the code with what the contractors are doing, particularly those who are who fall under the institution that has been created by housing. And also, the concern is based on the budget spending patterns by provinces. I'm saying this because if you look at KwaZulu-Natal and Eastern Cape, some of the problems were a little bit off the same, because later, before the MEC Mabuyakulu came in, we find that only same contractors were awarded those tenders, and they keep on shifting the building while they're making profit out of the government money. And at the end of the day, you'll find that the quality of houses are not of the quality that we said we want, and there are the members of the public, and I believe also the department. And the other one is just to check whether the department has got a retention policy or retention program to retain these people that have skills that you need in the department. Because I believe that people, when they are leaving, they always say, no, we're leaving for a greener pasture. So don't you have something to encourage those people to remain in the department? I don't know. But at the same time, I look at the figures in terms of the budget. In terms of your administration, there's also this compensation fund. That compensation fund is the increase of the salaries of the staff members in the department, including of the ministers. Is it budgeted for under that compensation fund? Because if it's not, then somehow maybe we're going to have a problem where we'll be able to pay for whatever agreement we have raised with the employees, between the employer and the employee. And also, I was looking at the possibility that if the that one should be out of the question. If the Mustineke proposal has been signed by the president, if the president agreed on that, I think you're going to have a bigger gap when it comes to the minister, because I saw that the minister is there in terms of salary and how are you going to deal with that.
Because they have to check, honorable colleagues, they have to check for time.
Yeah, Mr. President, I forgot to raise something. There was a situation where poor quality houses were demolished in the Eastern Cape. Are there any plans to do the same in all the provinces? And what is the how far is the project right now? If it's a project, and what is happening in other provinces? Because it was not only the Eastern Cape that had problem with those poor quality houses. All the provinces have the same. But I think we need to try and ensure that we do the same, so that these contractors must realize that we mean business when we say to them, we want quality houses. And the other issue is of the blacklisting of these contractors that are not performing up to the required standard. What are we doing about them? Why are we not blacklisting them? They keep on coming back over and over again, but keep on committing the same mistakes. They don't learn out of their mistakes. What are we doing about them? Thank you.
Thank you, honorable members. If I can just throw one coin in, please. I know it's quite a difficult question that I'm going to pose to you now, but I think that you're able to stand up to the challenge. the Joslogo settlement, as you are well aware that they've approached the Constitutional Court. The Constitutional Court has now made a ruling to say, listen, we will hear you out. And we want housing and the municipalities to come back to us to say that defend housing and why must you be moved? Have you preempted that if the Constitutional Court ruled in the favor of the Joslogo settlement, you will have a major crisis in this whole country in terms of squatter camps, the removal of squatter camps to far-flung areas, far away from the place. Have you preempted of maybe building around those people or say to them, look, we'll keep you here or we'll relocate you in about a kilometer radius. As far as I know, the Joslogo said that we are prepared to move within a kilometer, in a radius of a kilometer, but not further than where you want to put us, in Happy Valley and all that. If the Constitutional Court rules now, in this financial year, on this, it will have a very huge implication on your budget. Are you prepared for that?
There is an extent to which we don't want to go to the detail of a matter that is before the court. I think the arguments in the Supreme Court, to some of the merit issues, were dealt with, and therefore, in a way, they have been settled. And maybe the Constitutional Court is a process to provide the relative stamping of, seal of approval of what might be. But I think the point here is that we are aware of the significance of a counter decision that you may find for our program. Because the reality is that our interest is in ensuring that we've got a program that in all material, in terms of its material, in a material way, complies or achieves what is otherwise envisaged in our peaceful constitution. And therefore, in developing our program, one of the key things that we do is to ensure that is the way in which we are developing our program and policy, is it in line with the Constitution? Because that's really the litmus test. And I think therefore our view is the earlier those things are settled. Obviously, I think that there would be there are always issues of within limits, which are also provided for through the Constitution. So we're comfortable that from the rest of the country, in the long term, which would give us the opportunity to adjust, looking at the fiscal position of the department, would have to make those adjustments that would ensure that we are able to be aligned with the Constitution. But that the Constitutional Court would be the basis on which we can actually, with confidence, say we are convinced that that is the case. But up to now, we are convinced that quality control through the court seems to suggest that, by and large, our programs are fair, constitutional aligned, etc. And then at that stage, we'll then have to align with that. Thank you. I think our time is
because we have to deal with all of them.
To the Honourable Speaker, I do think that we do understand and respect the responsibility, the role of members of the House, our representatives. We certainly think that we would not pass a single day if we were in your shoes.
I think in developing our programs, we always seek to meet those requirements. And I think the challenges, notwithstanding the challenges that we have, we do understand that at least, and on a number of occasions, we do accept that there are those challenges, and there are practical issues that exist at the level at which we, at the levels of implementation to a large extent. And I think you've seen the COO did indicate the areas that we're trying to prioritize in order to try and bridge the gap of the expectations and recognizing that there is an intergovernmental relations framework that has to be accepted as a de facto situation. What we seek to do as we increase our capacity, I think, is in recognition, one, of the fact that given the level and the extent of our program and the growth, it is not a small growth. It is also a growth that has to address the challenges that the program is facing. We are not happy with our, for example, our monitoring capacity that we have, but we have to increase it over time. We also recognize that, in fact, as we answer you, we are faced with a situation where we have to answer for the older projects that we implemented prior, and they were subject of the evaluation that we did to actually recognize that we need to improve our program. And hence we put mechanisms that deal with those in rectifying the situation. We've got a rectification program. We've got a developed project program that also says you can't leave those projects. You've got to go back to those projects, assess them appropriately, and then put measures in place to ensure that they are resuscitated. Accepted them. There were people who, in the process, are culpable for the state of affairs that exists, be it the staff members in the municipality or province who might have colluded, their programs act against them appropriately. Where it is the contractors, they are also taken through and acted upon on that basis. The blacklisting arrangements are there. Currently, I think some of the loopholes have always been that the registration mechanism and therefore the conditionalities for somebody being accepted to allow. We are now increasing and improving our coordination with NHPR, so we keep a very good database of registered contractors, so that the project can register appropriately. People who are delinquent, either because of the implementation of the project and the past performance, etc., are deregistered through that process as well. I think that there will always be those cases where people change. You know, there are people who are very clever in the process. They either liquidate one entity and emerge in a different way. We also found that in the past we missed the situation where somebody runs from one province after having done something terrible, leave that company and go and have another one in a completely different name, and only get discovered later. So we consolidate the database. NHPR has a national database at the moment that uses it. And I'll leave there with some of the issues with the COO and then answer those that relate to the budget later. Like the compensation issues.
Chair, I'll be brief. There's no particular sequence. The land challenges are dealt with in two parts. The National Housing Development Agency, its mandate is to deal with that. But in the interim, while we don't have the agency, there are two solutions. Provinces, and I'm sure if that last slide on the presentation begins to show some entry in terms of land acquisition that provinces can use. On the other hand, in the interim, we're also acquiring land that's available for parastatals in the meantime. So there is work underway there. But predominantly the agency will deal with that. Chair, the fluctuations in that graph that I related to, there are many factors behind the fluctuation, and that is why we've had to go into each and every one of the provinces to look at the nuances and understand them. In some cases, you find that the dip was as a consequence of, then, say, the minimum norm in 40 square meters, whereas before that was 30 square meters. So that also had its impact. But there are a number of factors behind these, and we've had to drill into each one of the provinces. Now, Chair, I just want to refer the committee to page 24, where we isolate these challenges. Specifically, if you look at that number 7, where we've looked and scrutinized each of the housing delivery plans and found these weaknesses. Bullet number 1, 2, 3, 4, underneath 7. Isolate this multiple and irregular policy deviations and misinterpretation. It is a serious problem, Chair. We've isolated that. And it arises in many forms. A project gets started as a people's housing project. Halfway, it's converted to be something else. And hence, you find multiple problems around some of these projects. And therefore, I'm just saying, Chair, all of this risk, we've done the full value chain analysis. We've assessed each one of the provincial plans, assessed the block projects and so forth to appreciate the issues that are involved so that we can respond comprehensively to all of the problems that are known. Some of them are unknown, but we've uncovered those. Chair, and therefore, it brings me to then the question around the NHBRC capacity. And provinces have said there's a problem of the NHBRC doesn't have capacity, but when you probe, you realize that the NHBRC is not in a position to assemble capacity because it doesn't know which project the province is going to approve. And therefore, where the NHBRC works in tandem with the province, and there are cases, the Western Cape is one, some parts of KZN, some parts of Limpopo, some programs in the Northwest is problematic, but you find that there's the NHBRC and the province would agree, here are the 10 projects, we are enrolling these. They plan them jointly and so forth, and there are no problems. Where the province does its own thing, and then later calling the NHBRC and say, hey, here are the projects, can you enroll? In other provinces where there's a joint planning, the NHBRC, as it enrolls those projects and homes, what they then do, they attach capacity to those projects. They attach an inspector on a full-time basis to those individual projects. Now, we've had to break the cycle because you talk to the province, they point the finger at the province. At the NHBRC. You talk to the NHBRC, point the finger to the province. So we've then agreed, and the MINMEC concluded on the matter, that there will be joint planning between the NHBRC and the province. Which brings me to another issue, the quality control chair. The quality control is a cancer in our system. We've acknowledged that. There are measures that are in place to improve that. This joint planning with the NHBRC seeks to attend to that. I was in Limpopo this past weekend. We took some students to go paint some of the houses. Some of the houses we couldn't paint. You put a roller on the wall. Yeah, you walk the roller. It's a problem. You can't paint.
Exactly what I was saying.
Now, we then assembled on the site on Saturday morning the municipal official who was the project manager, the provincial official who was the project manager, the NHBRC people. Guess what, Chair? Somebody signed on the dotted line that this project, this work, complies with the technical requirements. Looking at it, you can tell this doesn't. There's a banana wall. It's like this. There's a gap between the door frame and the brick. The issue that the speaker is raising. Chair, it is very clear that there are multiple problems around that, and we are undertaking, I wouldn't say an investigation, but we are reviewing that inspection process to isolate areas but also recommend certain punitive measures. I am convinced that somebody approved payment for that project and said that project meets the quality standard. That person is the person I'm after.
That's the point for me.
Where is the book?
you can make that arrangement.
So I'm just saying, Chair, we have to, and I think the committee is correct in that we have to have a zero tolerance around these matters. And that goes back to the engine. The standards don't change, and I want to confirm that. The engineering standards, the technical norms, and stuff, they don't change, regardless of what structure is built for whom. What tended to happen is that, as the CFO has indicated, and that's a function of our special investigations unit, working with the City of Mayor, again, the special investigations unit. But there are certain instances where clearly there is some evidence of possible collusion. They need to be investigated and concluded as per the prosecutive route. And therefore, the other matters we will look into, Chair, to ensure that the quality control and the inspection process is optimal. Optimal in that the person who signs is the person who accepts liability. And from any industry, Chair, when you sign off any product and say, I certify this is correct, you are accepting liability, and it is those people who signed saying this project is sound, we can pay, and payment was made. So, Chair, we will look into, we are taking specific measures around that. Chair, the houses that were demolished in the Eastern Cape, the contractor was still on site, if I'm not mistaken. If the contractor was still on site, we went, we said, no, you can't proceed. This is substandard quality. This house must be demolished. They were demolished. A new contract. So that contractor is taken off the project. Clearly, he can't build, and therefore, he can't proceed with the work. And therefore, and there are different issues. Depending on where the project is at, you can actually demolish. Some projects require specific responses. So it's not necessarily a blanket. There have been media reports where the NHBRC has stopped a contractor from proceeding because they didn't comply with certain things. So there's a robust system that is there. And I do believe, Chair, that where there have been problems, they need to be looked at for what they are, and then accountability is demanded. In respect of the, I've spoken to the land problem. I have addressed the, now, Chair, just the last two issues in respect of those projects in the Eastern Cape that the committee visited, the minister was there, the individuals were there. The reality is twofold. While commitments were made, the accountability and the responsibility on one level rests with the province to take the necessary steps because they receive the grant, they are the implementer. Failing which, and I think in the Eastern Cape it's a pointed case because that's just not the one failure. There are many failures. Hence the intervention in terms of Section 100. Because certain things you couldn't say on a negotiated and consensus basis to begin to turn the issues. And therefore, those issues that were concluded, committed, they were never attended to. And there's limitation in terms of the spheres of government. We cannot take over a project unless you go through the Section 101B where you have to take over, relieve the MEC of the executive role, relieve the HOD of accountability responsibilities. We are not there yet. So those are some of the intergovernmental limitations. We've done project teams there. But for as long as the HOD can't or doesn't approve what needs to be approved, there's not much that can be done. So, and there are related problems. And I can confirm, Chair, that the accreditation process is very robust. It does demand that we look at an audit, a lot of these considerations. I think the municipality that is in question in KZN, as a case in point, Chair, I would have to look at that. In our record, there is no municipality that's accredited, except for the 18 that the housing minimum prioritized 2 years ago. And therefore, we would have to look at that specifically. What would have been the arrangements there, and so forth. But the accreditation process is so robust; it demands that a due diligence be done. And that is why, in certain cases, it does take long. And lastly, Chair, these spending patterns that we note and the forces and the factors behind each one of them, that's a matter that we are seized with from grant spending monitoring to actual delivery, because it's not just whether you spend the money. We are interested in what is the outcome of that expenditure. And therefore, we monitor on both fronts. We've given you the money, you've planned for these things. When the money flows, we are interested in what it's being spent on. And therefore, Chair, I would just want to allay the I don't want to say fear, but the deep concern that the committee holds. We are very much alive to this concern. This is probably the first year where we come to the committee with the institutional capability to attend to the issues. We are not saying we are going to restructure, No, it's done. Because these are matters that the committee has raised. We've subsequently responded to that, putting measures in place. What we are is then accountabilities are demanded, performance around these priorities are called for. Chair, there are matters that are institutional, the vacancy rates and so forth that my colleague will go attend to.
Okay, thanks, Chair. As the COO has indicated, that we are done with the restructuring process, and last year we went through a process of identification of critical posts. As you are aware, that we have upsized, not downsized. So also we needed to be the post needed to be funded over an MTEP period. But those newly created branches like service delivery support as well as monitoring and evaluation have been identified as being critical vis-a-vis the support services, which we're not saying is not important, yet it's important. Therefore, at a macro level, I can safely say the posts are funded and they are being filled. But however, also we have to take into cognizance that we need to also contest or compete with the private sector in the type of skills which we need around those areas. That is why in the key considerations which the COO has indicated, the mechanism of troubleshooting and working smarter, because of it's not about warm bodies as well. It's about also how you work smarter. You can have quite an entourage of practitioners. If you are not working smarter, you are not going to deliver. That is why we are looking at holistically in terms of capacity and capability, whether we are able to troubleshoot in other instances. And that also leads to the issue of retention, as the Honourable Member has asked, whether do we have a retention policy and a retention strategy. In the public service, it's the issue of compliance. It's a must that each and every government department has to have a retention policy and a retention strategy as the guidelines are stipulated by the DPSA. And emanating from there, there's a department where even looking into the whole a culture of how do we do things so that we become an employer of choice, because of research done by GTZ has actually indicated that people are leaving not because of salaries, even the work environment. So we are trying to improve constantly on that and benchmarking ourselves against the best in the private sector. And in terms of compensation of employees as well, it is a standard practice that when you budget your baseline, you provide for inflation. Obviously, now organized labor are talking about a two-digit increase. If the two-digit increase issue, if it comes through, it will is the duty of Treasury to provide for the top-up. But it is a standard practice that when you budget, you factor in your maybe your bonuses, your pay progression, as such, it is a given situation. Therefore, we can safely say we are covered in that.
Thank you. I think we have to.
The farm worker housing policy is at a very advanced stage of consultation. And subject to approval, we should be able to bring it to the committee maybe after the next meeting. We're talking about the second quarter, subject to approval by the
second quarter.
Second quarter of financial year, we should be able. We had sticky points with regard to on-farm housing assistance. We couldn't get we're not signing each other with Agri South Africa, the commercial farmers. But now we have relative consensus, we are able to do business. And we promise that we should be able to wrap up because all the city points are now addressed. So, second quarter is a commitment.
I think to ease the concerns of the members, we have a broad rural housing policy arrangement. It is not as if there is no arrangement that can be, because we develop a framework for engagement even with farmers. I think Western Cape is utilizing it to engage farmers who are willing, who are providing land, who actually need to provide those solutions. But the issue is that from a policy perspective, we then need to tie up these issues that will have legal, financial implications that need to be resolved. So in a situation where there is a cooperative arrangement between a municipality, the province, and a farmer, there is an instrument for them to actually provide for development already. Okay.
I think we've come to the close now. If there's no, like the Honorable Reverend would say, burning issues. We have come to the close for the budget briefing on the budget book. Mr. Shalibane and the CFO and your colleagues with the DDGs, we want to thank you for the. I know you had to do everything in quick time, but we want to thank you for also accommodating us and for allowing us. Oh, no, it's fine. She said that she, as long as it's not stronger than medicine, alcohol or something, you're covered. We want to say thank you very much. We're going over now to the final mandate. Is it the same people that we must deal with? The same people. For the final mandate.
For the record, I also would like to thank you, the committee, for the opportunity. I think in this engagement, it's been useful in that we also get the other perspective of some of the things we think we're trying to affect and what the realities are from the people who are polite.
encourage you to remain where you are.
Thank you very much.
You know, I don't think we will shoot down other Matlagani suggestion so quickly. If we can do that now, we can avoid elections next year.
I think and then come back after the election. They fight the election for us. Oh, I think what we need to do, what we need to do in our campaigning, we should take them along.
Yeah.
And we should just say to the people, here they are,
yeah.
Talk to them, let them explain. But thank you very much, honorable members. We are now going over to our welcome, back, Reverend. We are now going over to the final mandate on the social housing bill, B20B, 29B. Yeah, sorry for that, B29B. I think the COO and the DDG, Ms. Mbana. Am I correct? Ms. Mbana.
Mbale. Likely.
Mbale. Likely. Oh, Mbale.
Mbale.
Mbane. Oh, Mbane. You're lightning. You don't mind if I call you Miss Lightning or something. No. You won't do that. Miss Mbane, I think, members, it's 25 to 1. We can go on till about quarter past 1 or 1.
No. 5 to 1.
Or 5 to 1. But that depends on you. If you stop your meeting that side, we can carry on. And yeah. So if you stop all that, we can finish at 5 to 1. COO, are you ready now for us? For this? I believe you have to stand in for your other colleague. We apologize for, it was meant to take place at 2 o'clock, but we apologize, something cropped up. And, you know, we are in an institution that we also need to follow the rules, the regulations, and the discipline of the institution. So when the institutional bosses are calling us, you need to be disciplined. So I will start with the... Is there, have we got the bill here?
Don't need the bill.
Oh, okay. Eastern Cape, would you...
thank you, Chair. I have presented the final mandate from the committee and signed by the Speaker of the province. In it, in the content, there's a term of reference which refers to the bill itself and its process. The portfolio committee was briefed preceding on the following day after we attended the negotiating mandate committee meeting. And the mandate conferred on me is that the committee and the province agrees in the policy and content of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Precinct.
Jefferson, the resolution from Free State is that authority be conferred to the Free State delegation to vote for the adoption of the bill without amendment.
Thank you very much. That's the record time. I think you deserve what Alan Dero Matandiana is drinking. You deserve to have some of that. Gauteng, I don't think the member of Gauteng is here, so we'll just read the bill if it's okay with the members. Final voting mandate adopted by the committee, the Housing Portfolio Committee recommends that in terms of Section 65 of the Constitution, the House confer authority on the Gauteng Provincial Delegates to the National Council of Provinces to vote in favor of the Social Housing Bill.
In favor.
Tampopo?
In favor. I didn't already.
The committee, having supported the principle and provisions of the bill, recommends to this
August House to confer a final mandate to the NCOP permanent delegate to vote in favor of the bill to pass into law. I would like to bring to the attention of the committee that the final mandate was signed by the committee chairperson. And when I inquired, I was informed, acting chairperson, that the speaker was not available, the deputy speaker was also not available, and the secretary was also not available.
No, but there is a
I think Honorable Watson wants to be the speaker of the
Open.
So, I'm interested. When I got the mandate, that's what I inquired, and that's the reason that was forwarded to me. So I'm bringing it. I acknowledge this take, but that's what I was given. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Member. Honorable members, the helping one which we've just read now, let me just get your sharp witty brain. There's something wrong with it, and
it's not signed.
I wonder, can we accept it? I don't think we can accept it in terms of the mandating procedures. Well, thank you. So helping we can't accept. Thank you, Limpopo, for that. But you didn't say to us if you are in favor or what.
Yes, yes.
Lombopo, did you say?
Yes. Chairperson, I did.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you. Thank you, ma'am.
She even called us the August
Can we just stop that meeting then? Thank you. Where are we now? Mpumalanga.
Hey, Mpumalanga. Very difficult. The delegation representing the province of Mpumalanga in the National Council of Provinces is hereby concerned with authority and mandated to vote in favor of the bill signed by Mrs. Poza, not Mr. Poza, Speaker of Mpumalanga.
Thank you, Honorable Watson. Northern Cape, would you... I'll read the final voting mandate. In terms of Section 65 of the Constitution, the House confers authority on its permanent delegate to the NCOP to vote in support of the social housing bill signed by the Speaker. Accepted?
Yes.
Northwest?
Northwest, Jefferson, when we had a negotiating mandate, they said they were forward the final mandate. And in the final mandate, the point three resolution, the proposal committee has been considered with the interests and views of the public resolved that the permanent delegate should support the amendment.
Yes. Sorry, Honorable Reverend. Can you just turn the mic, please, because we are recording.
Sorry.
Can I just, before the Reverend goes on, raise a point of order? The document in front of us speaks to Bill B29A. And we're actually dealing with B. A is just the amendments of the National Assembly.
Yeah, I think
Reverend has explained that there was no negotiating mandate.
Meeting.
Yeah, but the thing is, B29 is the original vote. A is only the amendments of the National Assembly.
Yeah, so there's a slight problem. Yes, Reverend. With this final mandate. Yeah, they refer to B29A. It should be B29B.
A roles and responsibilities stipulated in page 3 under chapter 2, the bill should also include traditional But how do we do this? This is the final mandate. Should this not have appeared under the negotiation mandate? Should I read this?
Chairperson, I was of the opinion that this is related. Let's just leave it. Because it was supposed to have come under the
Should I leave it?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Because
I think they're delayed.
The authority
yeah.
to support the vote.
Okay.
Check and submit. It says to submit. It's not with this. It says to submit.
Yeah.
But I think there is one clause here that. Is this one on the wall?
No.
Are you cool?
No.
The on the last page, there should be an invisible blah blah blah. It says the National Portfolio Committee on Housing should ensure that both referred to provinces are drafted in languages understood by the citizens of that province. It's also a message that my province has asked me to convey very strongly that they have to have to conduct hearings, public hearings, to people who speak predominantly Siswati and endeavour it. And the only thing I could find was the Kosa one. They considered that insult. And I would ask that we do ask the department to be sensitive about that one.
Well, we've got the CEO here and the DDG of corporate services. I think the message has been conveyed to them. Honorable Nia, you wanted to say something?
No, just indicating that in our province, we use the capacity within the legislature of translators. There are translators employed, Sotho, Xhosa, Afrikaans. And then before we go to public hearings, we make copies of those translations. I'm not sure whether we have the same capacity in the province. But I don't think the department has, I'm not sure, at the provincial level.
Okay, can we just finish the mandates and then we'll go to that? Also in your response, CEO. Okay.
Yeah, otherwise, they say I should support the fee.
Thank you, everyone. Yeah, I missed one problem. Okay, is it there?
They wrote to the chairperson of the council and also to the chairperson of the committee. For a week so that they can be able to deal with the negotiation mandates that were tabled by various provinces. Because at the same time they were also concerned that they raised some amendments of which they were not responded to. And then I think they are meeting, they are going to have their meeting on Friday, where they are going to do the final meeting. But I have encouraged them that at least before the debate in the House, we must get that final meeting. That's what they comment.
Thank you, Western Cape. It says here the Western Cape Provincial Parliament, having considered the subject of social housing bill, B29B 2007 NCOP referred to the Provincial Parliament in terms of the rules of the National Council of Provinces, begs to report that it confers on the Western Cape delegation in the NCOP the authority to support the bill with the following amendments. Now that's why I was asking whether whether these amendments are being included, because these amendments are also part of the negotiating mandate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we've got a written response from the housing department. Yeah. The proposals were agreed and accepted by the written submission. So the Western Cape also supports that.
Sorry, what happened to these amendments, sir?
It says here from the response to NCOP about the amendments. And the negotiating and mandate, they give responses for the provinces. It says, the Western Cape, the proposals were agreed and accepted for the written submission. So the amendments of the Western Cape has been were agreed to by the department, and it has been accepted by them.
But Chair, that means that the bill is now amended by us if we do vote in favor of those amendments in the House.
Mm.
That means it has to go back to the National Assembly.
Yeah. We vote on it with the amendment that we have proposed, pass it with the amendment that we have proposed, and then it goes back to the NAS.
But then they must now produce
a C bill.
No, a D. A C is only the amendment adopted, and a D would then be the bill that we vote on.
Yeah, you're right there. So the department has to do that. Honorable Fabian.
But the amendment that I got from the Free State is to vote in favor without the amendment. Yes, mine too.
Yeah.
No, that's still a problem.
But I think, isn't that the amendment without the amendment of the Free State?
Mm-hmm.
Has the Free State made amendments?
Without amendment. Doesn't matter who's amendment.
No.
The province is
now
didn't have the privilege of looking at those amendments.
In terms of the response that we got from the Department of Free State, 2.10. But maybe our legal advisor can just inform us, advocate as well.
Yes, Mr. Chair, this is not my forte. This is actually the committee section. But my take on it is that this sounds to me like a negotiating mandate. And so what the other provinces have agreed to without amendments means that they haven't seen these amendments before them, and they have in fact voted now on a different bill to the one that we're voting on. So this to me would tantamount to a negotiating mandate, not to a final mandate.
But
I'd like to initiative to have another meeting and to look at the bill that has been incorporated with the that we are talking about.
Mm.
And then we're not going to say this is the final amendment because clearly there are amendments that are there now on the show.
Yeah.
Therefore, we need to take that vision, and then after that, we'll just discuss with you the power of the
we can just make a ruling on that this is not our final mandate meeting. We are deferring this for another meeting which will be set up by the secretary. And also if the secretary can let all the other provinces and members have the responses of this. I think I've got mine from the province.
But you send it to me, but you send it to the province.
Okay.
Yeah. I think by the provinces now need the C version, so that I can get a new mandate.
But that's not the point that I was asking for. Where is the vote that includes the amendment?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it's the first time that since I've been here now that I'm doing final mandate, there's no bill that includes the mandate. We should have a bill, a C bill, like the Honorable Watson said, that should have included these mandates, because these negotiating mandates were sent to the department. So, but I think we'll remedy the situation, we'll defer it, the department should come with a C bill that includes these amendments, because it's simple to say to us, the amendment has been agreed to, and it's not included. It could be that we've debated the thing and passed the thing, and it's not been included into the vote. Honorable Watson?
Yes, and I'll just get the mic my way. You see, there's now a big problem of process. Because, and that's what I was trying to fight against in so many venues, the committee, the programming committee, etc. We do a negotiating mandate last week, Wednesday. A variety of amendments are suggested in those negotiating mandates. A letter comes from the department. I even phoned from Nelson to ask whether I got it too late for my meeting. But then, a week later, we get mandates.
without knowing how these things have been incorporated. I think what we need is that once we've got negotiating mandates, there should be a second step where those negotiating mandates are presented by the department for legal implications and then presented to us in a T format. And if we then approve that, give that back to the provinces for a final mandate. Now they've given us negotiating mandates, and somewhere at the same time they're writing out the final mandate. There's something terribly wrong in our process. And it applies to the NEMA votes that we've got in front of us. I can see problems coming up.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I think the department has done their job in this respect. They have the state law advisors here. And I think we must be very clear on where our separate functional areas lie. They have attended to the policy implications. The state law advisors are here who have to attend to the C-list amendments. And the committee has to decide. The fact that the Western Cape, for example, has put this before the committee doesn't mean that the committee has decided and agreed to this. So that process has to take place before the state law advisors can take it further and compile that final amendment list.
But in the meantime, we've got final mandates.
Yeah, so
it's
the
totally
final,
wrong.
The final mandate is much of literature. Yeah. So you're not looking at the same document.
The whole question is how does the department and the state law advisor relate with one another? Because these responses come from the department to say that it has been agreed to, your amendment that you proposed have been agreed to, and I mean it will be captured into the bill.
Yeah.
Honorable Makanyan.
Yeah, Chairperson, I think we agreed last time we had a meeting last week Wednesday to get the secretary to the committee must forward the amendments to the provinces. I received mine while I was in the province already. But what it says is that the provincial committee must sit down and look at the amendments that came from different provinces, then come up after that. Come up with a final
meeting.
Sorry.
Honorable McLennan, your
protest, Karen. Yeah, because I think that's where the problem is. The amendments from different provinces were sent to provinces, but other provinces never even considered those amendments. That's why right now we're sitting in the COVID.
Look, I received my this report.
Provinces cannot react on a piece of paper from a department. It has to be in the form of a bill. It's only legal if it's in the form of a bill, either an A or a B or a C or a D. It cannot give a mandate on a B subject to what's now written in the memorandum. It cannot happen. We'll go with that in the Constitutional Court, I'm telling you now.
Honorable Mark.
What I know, we have a negotiating mandate, which implies provinces shall have forwarded their proposal. And during the negotiating mandate, we must agree on those proposals. If those proposals are rejected, it's a different story.
Yes.
And the negotiating mandate, then we have a package of what we have agreed all together. Then it's forwarded to provinces on what was agreed by other provinces, whether their proposals have been agreed upon or not. It's not that we expect to have the final mandate. You know, and today we're supposed to be dealing with the final mandate. But it seems that, and that's why I was saying the proposals from my province are belated, because they were not part of the negotiating mandate last week, so that we cannot consider them today. And that's that. And when we agree on proposals from provincial proposals, the department should take that and make it one thing, as agreed during the negotiating mandate. by this comment. Then we forwarded them to the province for final mandate. And if the Free State is saying without amendment, if we had amendment during the negotiating mandate, it should be with those amendments.
Yeah. That's the problem.
So I don't know where we are, what did the department do? Did they incorporate the amendments agreed upon by all the 9 provinces? If so, then the final mandate should say with incorporation of those amendments.
Thank you, sir. My name is Dominique from State Advisors. Sir, I'd like to just explain that the sea bill is the result of the final mandate. So we're here today to find out what are the amendments agreed to by the 9 provinces so that we can be able to compile a sea bill. So we can't compile a sea bill for the provinces to take back. The Western Cape mandate is the same as the other mandate. So the issue is whether other provinces agree with the Western Cape mandate, which contains, which proposes amendments. So today we came to find out whether they agree, because that document was discussed during the negotiating mandate. So today, well, if they confirm that they accept the document, after today we're preparing the speech.
Sorry, what
yeah.
document
is
the
radio
says?
The Western Cape mandate of the Western Cape.
Sorry, Chair. Can I just focus with the rest of the legal team and the procedural team for 2 minutes? Because you're getting conflicting advice here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I just want to meet with them for 2. I know we have a time problem, but it's important that we resolve this.
Yeah, okay. There's a 2 minute break. Just 2 minutes.
That short period between negotiating and final, where and when do you incorporate
the negotiating mandate to the final mandate?
Yeah. Well, even Jewish, what do the provinces consider in their final mandate?
The final mandate.
They got the B-boats. Of all the things we've said to them was the B-boats. So what happens to those proposals?
And the proposal the department should respond if the negotiating mandate is needed.
And then? All the provinces had. All of them had.
And then the Western Cape one, I think they took it because, one, in terms of the issue of clause 2, in principle, everything was agreed, but the question was, how do you, in terms of the clause, they were supposed to clarify that.
Well, it's in, yeah, still in some of these documents.
Yes. And then, because we're not sure whether, but they agree that, no, in terms of that law, they are going to try and...
Everyone, that has been arranged in all the assembly.
But on the last one, in terms of the regulation, we all agree that we need to participate as parliament.
Yes.
After consultation and... Also after consultation with parliament.
Yes.
And in principle, that one is what I agreed upon. So I think if the department, if they are saying
they've only considered that one. Then I can say it means the others then fall off. But if they say they agreed on all of them, then I'm having a problem. Because we're not agreeing in principle on all the amendments.
Because I went through the five of the mandates. Very clearly say that referring to the B-Bill and not with any memorandum. That memorandum only came on Friday afternoon.
Which is why when I drafted the NEMA bill program, I said, I started off with the Buddha briefing. I left 2 weeks for the public hearing provinces. Then we had the negotiating mandate. We left it a week, and that's when I included another meeting and said, the department's response to negotiating mandate. And then I had a final mandate meeting, because to avoid this issue.
But you see the point I'm making.
We need to have a meeting where we're going to deliberate on the amendments that have been proposed. Because he said, let the proposed amendment go to provinces, and provinces must listen to them. And if they agree, then they must come up with the amendment, the other amendment. So we have to deliberate on that.
So I think in future, then what we should do is then have it like, but maybe, like when we have our negotiating mandate meeting, a week later we have another meeting to discuss the amendments made by the provinces, and then a week later we have a final mandate meeting.
Yeah, but Oscar, you can only do that if you produce a C-bill.
Yeah, so
a C-bill is the one that's
changed.
No, they're not included. Only the amendments to the bill.
Yeah.
And then if we accept it, then they produce a D, which is then incorporating the NCLP amendment.
Okay,
yeah.
Can we get down to business now? Okay, Mr. Bauer, thank you. Just your overseeing. Advocate Adekai, talk to us.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Before I hand over to the State Law Advisor, I just want to very quickly remind the committee that the department's tasks are completed now, and the task of formulating and articulating the committee's views and the final version is in fact where the State Law Advisor comes in. I advise you on content and constitutionality and other stuff that could arise. But in terms of process, there are different people, so I will leave it to the State Law Advisor, who is the person who this changes and process resides with. So she will take you through the process. But I think I have Honourable Watson already articulate the correct position.
State
Law
Advisor, talk to us.
Thank you, Chair. As
Cindy
said, that the CDs will only be prepared once the provinces are speaking with one voice, and like whether they are accepting the Western Cape Amendment, if Western Cape is the only province to propose an amendment. So that is what must be considered now before we can be able to produce a system. Taking into consideration that other provinces didn't propose any amendment.
Yes, they did. They did. Every province had amendments.
Then the question is whether those amendments are accepted by this committee, then they will form part of the committee. We must know what amendments are accepted by this committee.
Okay. All right. Okay. Correct. Honourable McKenna.
The role of the province is there. Because there are amendments that were effected by provinces after public hearing. Then, after we met as a committee, each and every province recommended its own amendment. Then, what is the process? Because I understand what Honorable Watson was saying, that the provinces have to consider the amendments by other provinces.
Yes.
That's what I understand. And then, if the seed bill is not out, then what do we deal with then? Because I have to talk to my province right now. What do I say to them? They got the amendments by other provinces, but how do they react to those amendments? That's something else now.
All right, I think the
provinces, that they are proposed amendments from various provinces. And then provinces are supposed to discuss those amendments from different provinces. And today, we're supposed to be based on the proposed amendments by the provinces last week. KwaZulu-Natal agrees on this proposal, and they don't support this proposal.
Yes.
And then that has gone to, that was going to allow this committee to say, in terms of the consensus, how many provinces supported this amendment. And then those amendments, the amendments that were going to be put on the new bill that was going to be a C version. And then after that, we were going to say, okay, after the bill has been incorporated, all the amendments, okay, we have agreed upon. Then we're going to go through it and then take a final decision to go through it. That is my understanding. So today it's clear that provinces really they didn't go through that particular process. Therefore, I'll propose that one, we inform our provinces that based on the proposed last week, what are on their rules, they are not specific. Because, for example, if a one province is saying, discussing that it supports this bill without amendment. But previously, they had their proposed amendment. And then they have to state that they withdraw what they have proposed as the amendment, because some other provinces, maybe they have to discuss that. Probably, Chairperson, we need to have another meeting.
Can I get second as to that proposal? You second?
No. I want to ask a question.
Florian second and
I want David to
second. Okay, Honorable Watson first, then Honorable.
Let's give you sound out to it. See, what I said previously was sound, so you're moving into a soundless roof. My problem is told, final mandate has to be concerned by a legislature in city. A legislature can only give mandate on a bill, not on a document from this body. So the C bill must be before, that's my view. A C bill must be before the province to confer final mandate. Because that's what they will debate on and vote on in the NCOP. Is on the C bill. But I agree with the Reverend. We really need clarity on this whole process. I think we've been out of order for some time.
All right.
I think we have been in the NCOP for the past 10 years almost. And therefore we should be knowing what we're doing. During the negotiating mandate, provinces shall have submitted proposals for us for further amendments. And if the Northwest come up with proposals, it has to be looked into whether other provinces agreed with those proposals coming from the Northwest. And if the other provinces agree, then it's taken up as an amendment for the 9 provinces. It must be agreed, that particular proposal. Then we go to the next province in that way. If we have 5 provinces proposing amendments and it is agreed by all the 9 provinces, it's now formulated back to the 9 provinces for final mandate. Because that's why we call that meeting negotiating money. I must negotiate with other provinces that they buy in the Northwest proposal amendment. Then if it is agreed by the 9 provinces, we know that the 9 provinces has agreed on the proposal coming from this particular province. Now it is up for the 9 provinces. We forward it now to the 9 provinces to endorse and say, now that is our baby, that is the final mandate, And it must be incorporated now into the bill. And that's why the chairperson was saying, where is the bill? So that then we go clause by clause.
Exactly.
During the final Monday. To say now just being agreement.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the final Monday. That's how it should work. But I hear us saying we did not do justice when we were dealing with the negotiating Monday. Somebody did not capture what's supposed to be captured. And that's why I'm saying the Northwest did not have a negotiating Monday. And therefore they cannot now come up with proposals for amendment.
What's the way forward?
Yes. You mean for now?
Yeah. What's the way forward?
For now, we must check every problem. We must go to last week. Whether were there proposals from the Free State which were accepted by the nine provinces? If it was not accepted, it goes off. We go to the other provinces. Were there proposals accepted? If there was nothing, then it means Free State would be correct by saying we accept without any amendment. The statement of the Free State would be then be correct. To say we accept without any, because there was no any amendment accepted from any province. If there were, then Free State would say we accept with amendment.
Because we didn't accept any amendment from the negotiating.
During our negotiating Monday, which means it without.
No, I think the, if I can make a ruling, sorry, because time is really catching up on us. I think we defer this meet, we defer. No, you should be correct, but defer the English people, this meeting, for next week, where we then discuss this mandate.
The negotiating
mandate between provinces.
Yeah.
And then from there we can take the process further to the final mandate. Have I got the consensus to that?
Chairperson, if you say we now lost and we want to go back to the drawing board, I hear you saying if we go to the drawing board, then we go to last week. What was needed last week as negotiating mandate? And check them one by one. Whether are there proposals for amendment? If there is none, that's what's supposed to have been here today, where provinces are saying we accept without amendment. If there are amendments, then we have another bill, like the honorable member was saying, because it has been agreed by the nine provinces. That is why we're talking about negotiating Monday, to convince other provinces. And that's why KZN comes always, so that they back up their issue, to convince other provinces. If there was no any proposal that was accepted, and it sends back again to provinces, provinces would say we accept without any amendment. But you say now, because of time, we cannot say bring the negotiating mandate that we have now. If we had time, we could do that.
I think we can do it next week. Bring that negotiating mandate. Look, the whole process was normally, the process is there's two negotiating mandate meetings scheduled for province.
Yes.
And I think in this case, there was only one.
Yes.
And also scheduled for the committee also, there's two negotiating mandates. We normally have one negotiating mandate, and then if there's any amendments in that, we negotiate with province, then we have another follow-up negotiating mandate where these things are sent to the mandate or the amendment are sent back to provinces. And provinces then have another negotiating mandate meeting, and they send it back to us where the committees have another negotiating mandate meeting where we say, okay, fine, we accept to go with negotiate mandate. We accept the amendment of Limpopo. And then after that, when we got consensus, then it's been sent to provinces, and provinces then gives us the final mandate. So I think that the process here, because of the
the time composition of the institution was not followed properly, because there should be two negotiating managers. So I think we can argue now as much as possible, but I think if I can make the ruling, colleague, that we go, that we refer this meeting and come back next week to do it properly. Can I have your approval for that? Thank you very much.
You're confusing things much more. You're really confusing things much more.
In what sense?
As you're saying, we have two negotiating mandates, and the provinces have two negotiating mandates, which means there's also two final mandates. If you're confusing things more, it's so simple and straightforward. It's so simple and straightforward. We have only one negotiating mandate.
I'm talking about meetings.
Why meeting? We're talking about negotiating mandate and final mandate. Now, which is the problem here?
You see, maybe we've been misunderstood each other along the way. Because how can my problem, if we come here with the negotiating mandate of the first meeting, we produce our negotiating mandate. Right? Now, how can my problem give a final mandate when they haven't seen the amendments of the other provinces? So the amendments of the other provinces, which were produced by the negotiating mandate by the first meeting, needs to go back to the provinces.
Yes.
Because some of the provinces haven't seen these amendments of the other provinces. So we had a one negotiating meeting last week, and the amendments were tabled. The department has sent out the responses to the provinces. But I don't think that the provinces have seen much of these amendments from the other provinces. So the provinces need to go sit with these, as you have rightly said, with these amendments to say that, okay, we'll support Free State on that amendment. We're in line with Northwest with that amendment, or no, it's not. Confer to the permanent delegate that support the bill with amendments. So then we come back to the negotiating mandate here again and says, but we have seen now the amendment, we support the bill. And then we go back to final mandate. We can't have two final mandate meetings.
Mm-hmm.
So we have two negotiating mandate meetings. Yeah, the one is we introduce the amendments to this to the committee. The other one is this committee, permanent delegate, takes it back to the provinces. They say this is the amendment from all the other provinces. Because let's just hear the state law right. I mean, that has been, we have done that all the way, colleagues.
Before the state law advisor, I just need to say that in order for the state law advisor to do the C-list, she needs to know what the provinces' feelings are about these states. That is why that is the only step that has been dropped off. So the committee has actually missed that step. So she's not in a position to collate a C-list for you to get a final mandate. So that is all that needs to be done. So if this committee had last week after these submissions, been able to take a position.
But you couldn't.
You couldn't. Why?
Because they were not collated by the department.
You needed to go back to come.
Colleague, with all due respect, really, I'm making a final ruling now. And I think provinces have supported me on this thing. I'm going back again. I'm making a final ruling that we defer this whole matter back. We defer this matter to next week. We have a full meeting next week with more time. We can then discuss the matter, but in the meantime, colleagues should go back to the provinces to say, or just inform the provinces I've received the amendments of the other provinces.
No, okay, but
if there is no amendment. But
on the point of order, you've now put in another thing and say, in the meantime, I've already given my province all the mandate, all the different negotiating mandates, but they've not seen the summary. Or maybe they got it later. That part I don't know, you see. Mr. Willifont at our meeting said what we should do, we should take back to our provinces all these negotiating mandates. I put them in the bill and I gave them to my chairperson. I don't know what he's done to it afterwards. But what I'm saying
a composite view has not been produced. That's the only point I'm making.
That's exactly what Jefferson, can I tell you? The trade mistake lies, you know, after provinces attending negotiating Monday, it must be negotiated here.
Yes.
To be agreed upon.
Yes.
We didn't. That's why the mistake lies. The leading of that meeting, that's key. To check, and that's why we take province by province. We take all what that province is proposing, and we must check whether, if there are proposals, whether do we agree with this proposal.
Yeah.
If we don't agree, we say no, we don't agree with that province. Then we put it aside. But somebody should be collecting this thing.
The department.
Up to the end. At the end, we have everything in one.
Yeah.
Which is, you don't send all the negotiating mandates to the provinces. You send the agreed version
by the committee.
You get my point? That's how it should be. And that's where the mistake lies. And we never had this problem for the past 10 years. We are experiencing
wrong.
But we don't say geometry. It's not geometry. The problem started last week. It doesn't start with you. Don't feel guilty at all. The problem was last week. We didn't do the work according to how we should have done.
Thank you. No. Look, colleagues, I was not here last week, so it means to say that you that were here last week didn't do your job. Thank you. Honorable, what is that?
I've been for a couple of meetings.
It was not the responsibility for the department to compile what was proposed by the province. Us as members who that one, the copies of the various provinces to be sent to borrow. For example, was in Natal, when I was there on Thursday, those copies were already there. And the reverend proposed that the minutes of that particular meeting should accompany those proposed amendments to borrow. So that when the provinces go through those proposed amendments, they should be guided by those members. Unfortunately, honorable members, the minutes were not accompanying those proposals precisely because you can't send the minutes that are not adopted by the committee. You can't accept that. That was the decision that was taken by the very same committee. Therefore, Chairperson, based on that, I would say, let us close the meeting, let us have a meeting next week, and we must make sure that the provinces go through those proposed amendments by the committee, and then you must come up with a final amendment.
Thank you. That was also my ruling.
Thank you.
Colleagues, the meeting is adjourned. There's lunch in all the same. I don't know if the lunch is correct.
Yeah, so good. Then my mandate is valid. I gave them all those things. But they don't know what our negotiated mandate is. But the minutes didn't reflect the minutes should reflect what the consensus were. And there was never a consensus meeting.
There's no valid mandate here.
No?
No. I don't think the committee knows. The committee knows what to do in their province in this respect.
I don't know either.
No, I'm very worried about it. And this is
I think I can ask you a favor.
The committee
You must speak. Somebody must speak to Mr. Chow, and he must give us the advice.
Is it the tower
now? No, he's in the West Coast.
understand the way